This is the Misdirected Mark Podcast, a podcast about gaming, game mastering, and entertaining you, our listeners. We are explicit, and you have been warned, and I'd like to thank Mike Willard for letting us use his music on our show. Now let's pick up those mics and get on with this thing.
You're killing me, Smalls.
I'm Eli.
And I'm Phil, or PK if you prefer.
And I'm Old Man Simon. Well, the old man for this trio, anyway. So we're here to have a response. That's sort of what this episode is for. That's what this podcast, this one-time podcast, maybe one time, don't make us do this again. But this is going to be our one-time podcast where we respond to a Misdirected Mark episode. The episode we're responding to is episode 250. And basically, guys, check me on this if you feel this way. But we basically didn't think that anything they said in that episode was wrong, just that we wanted more. We wanted to make it more complete.
Absolutely.
I think that's fair.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to go ahead and start that off. And what we're going to do to start that off is a definition, which is definitely something that was missing in that episode. And we want to go ahead and define martial arts. So Eli, what are martial arts?
Yeah, well, first of all, it turns out the dictionary has what I would consider to be a woefully incomplete definition of martial arts because they only focus on Eastern martial arts. And as we all know, there are more than just Eastern martial arts. So we've kind of developed our own definition. And what we've got working with right now is a structured approach to combat that includes general philosophies, broad strategies, and specific tactics. Martial arts can be developed for sport or practical application, and could involve any number of combatants, and can include a variety of armed and unarmed variations.
Okay, so that's a lot of pieces. Can we break some of those down? So we've got a structured approach to combat. What do you mean by structured?
Yeah, so it's not as if you're just getting into the ring and you're swinging willy-nilly. There is a, like we say later, there's a general philosophy to how you approach combat in this situation. And from what I know of martial arts, most of them default to efficiency. Later on in the definition, we talk about the difference between sport and practical application. A lot of sport applications, like, for example, Chinese wushu, which is basically just martial arts gymnastics, that is still structured, but it's not about efficiency, it's about flash, it's about panache. So whichever end of the spectrum you find yourself on there, it's still a system that has a set amount of techniques and, like we say, you know, broad strategies and specific tactics. So the difference between those two, for people who don't know, strategies are something like an overarching plan of approach. Whereas a tactic is something like a chunk that contributes to the overall strategy. For example, if my strategy is to get to the second floor of a building, my tactics are going to be taking the first step up the stairs, the second step up the stairs, etc. So that's kind of what we're looking at. And then the philosophy of combat, sometimes the goal is to disable somebody, sometimes the goal is to escape from something, sometimes the goal is to harm or even kill someone, and these are all different approaches that you can have within the structure of a single martial art.
Cool. PK, any thoughts on anything you want to add or clarify in the definition?
Yeah, I'd like to just add that throughout history and across many different cultures, the philosophies have expanded to be not just combat applications, but also form the basis of morality and codes of conduct in general society for a warrior class. We see this with chivalry in the West, but also with the code of Bushido and other things in Eastern societies.
So in many ways, the culture of combat extends beyond just the fight itself.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I would say it even extends beyond the training into, like PK said, an actual lifestyle.
Mm-hmm. Cool. All right, tell us more, Eli.
Yeah, so martial arts are, of course, ubiquitous in gaming, but not everybody necessarily thinks of it that way. when a lot of people think about martial arts, they think about Eastern martial arts, kung fu, karate, judo, ninjutsu, whatever you want to say. But of course, there are a variety of Western martial arts. There are a variety of martial arts from the Southern Hemisphere. Pretty much every culture has some sort of tradition for defending themselves, and over time that's been refined into, like we said, a structured approach. With a lot of game systems, the martial art is implied, but it is Western martial arts. With Dungeons and Dragons in particular, fantasy is almost always based on Western traditions. You've got longswords, you've got rapiers, you've got all sorts of specifically Western weapons. And these rule systems, these combat mechanics, are all kind of an abstraction of Western martial arts. But that's not necessarily intuitive to a lot of gamers.
Yeah, I think there were certainly mechanics in previous editions of D&D that made that more apparent, like speed definitely implied more of the mechanics of the Western martial arts, but I don't know that that's as clear in current fantasy gaming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the general trend has been toward abstraction for a lot of different systems, and in that regard, a lot of modern combat mechanics are not so much about emulating a particular style as they are in just efficiently adjudicating the rules of conflict in a game.
Yep. Anything to add to that, PK?
I always like to think that the reason that we have grappling rules in D&D is because someone in the 70s was a big fan of Greco-Roman wrestling in the Olympics.
I could buy that, yes. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and actually, that's one thing that we don't see as much. We don't realize, but definitely wrestling is a huge part of a lot of Western martial arts, mm-hmm. And so
actually, there are some really great examples of wrestling techniques in longsword manuals from the 14th and 15th centuries. Because the longsword was not as it is portrayed in movies, where you're swinging at each other from a distance. It was up close and personal and dirty, and one of the ways you could win the fight was by controlling the other guy's blade. So you would reach out and grab it and hold on to his blade as you stabbed him with yours. And so there are a lot of which Eli will get into in a minute, a lot of HEMA traditions or schools that focus on grappling with swords, which is actually really cool to watch.
Absolutely. Yeah. There's a video, I can't remember the name of this thing, but if we have show notes, we'll definitely include it in there. It's an Italian fencing school that has a duel between two longsword fighters, and eventually both of them become unarmed. And one of the cool things to see is how seamlessly they transition from longsword dueling to unarmed dueling and then back to armed longsword dueling. And yeah. I've had an occasion to study a little bit of HEMA at a fencing academy here in Chicago. And their basic training method is derived from the historical text that PK was talking about. And the long pun not intended, the long story short of it is that the foundation of the training is with the longsword. You learn the longsword because it's a very average weapon compared to like a spear or an axe, a pole arm of some kind, or a dagger or something like that. And the techniques themselves really don't change much between the weapons. But once you've learned the longsword, you switch to learning dagger techniques, which are the same moves. They're just adapted to one-handed use, and they involve a lot more close quarters combat with a lot of grappling and that sort of thing. But in the same sense that when you're fighting with a longsword, the goal is to both, with a single movement, strike and deny your opponent from striking, often in the form of a blade control in the course of your cut. With unarmed combat or with dagger combat, it's the same sort of thing. Whenever somebody strikes at you, you intercept that. And not only do you strike back at them, but you also control their movement with, like a joint lock or with a throw or something like that. And You see that a little bit in other martial arts, but I haven't seen it anywhere that's quite as explicit as it is in HEMA in terms of the translation of techniques from one weapon or an arm style to another. But yeah, you can see it everywhere, particularly in a lot of Japanese arts. They're very similar. You know, kendo and karate and judo all have a lot of similar techniques. They're just adapted for different purposes.
I think this would be a good time to explain what HEMA is.
Yeah, just going to ask, what is HEMA?
Yeah, so HEMA, HEMA is, it's an acronym for Historical European Martial Arts. And the idea behind HEMA is that the people who practice it have studied these extant manuals from Italy, from Germany, later on from Spain and the United Kingdom, or I guess England as well at the time. And there are all these different approaches. The ones from Italy and from Germany are more often than not using the longsword as a base, whereas the later arts, which come from Spain and England, are rapier-based. But still, it's a unified system within each tradition, but you do have separate traditions. So the Italian approach is going to be slightly different from the German approach. A lot of the stances and a lot of the strikes are going to be similar, but it would be like the difference between American English and British English. You're going to have slightly different flavor depending on what region you're coming from, but all of them are compatible enough that there are tournaments that go on today, every year, all over the world, actually, where people practice HEMA, and they have their individual styles from whichever manuals they happen to come across. I know some of the big people in the art. Fiore De Liberi is the big Italian guy. Johannes Lichtenauer is the big German guy, but there are a lot of other people too, Meyer and stuff like that. And then I'm not too familiar with the Spanish or English styles myself because I've focused more on longsword than rapier.
Mm-hmm. No, from people who know, I am aware that if you are listening to the dialogue in the Princess Bride duel, that is a good bibliography of people to study.
Absolutely. Yeah. Capoferro. What are some of the other ones? Benetti's Defense.
Bonetti.
Agrippa. Yeah. Yeah.
These are all.
Yeah, Benetti. Yeah, that's the one. But yeah, they're all real historical fencers, and you can study their techniques.
So I think one of the things that we're saying in this section, at least, is we're talking a lot about the Western martial arts just to kind of drive home the fact that martial arts is not a thing that people choose to add to their game, with the few exceptions of games that don't have any attacking or damage. Games have martial arts.
Absolutely.
They just do.
Yeah. If you have combat and if it has any structure, then it's a martial art.
Yep. The problem that we run into, you sort of got into this before, is that difference between the way we see it in media and the way it is in the real world. So, Eli, could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So the closest I came to talking about media would have been the Chinese tradition of wushu, which is, you know, like I said, basically martial arts gymnastics. And that's the sort of thing you're going to see in a wuxia film or something like a Hong Kong action film or something. It's going to be the really flashy, lots of flips and spins and back and forth dueling and that sort of thing. But it's also a close cousin.
Can I interrupt for a moment?
Sure, go ahead.
And specifically, the reason we see that is because wushu is what was taught in the Chinese opera schools.
Right.
And the Chinese opera schools is where the Hong Kong film industry recruited its performers.
Mm-hmm. I know Jackie Chan came out of a particular opera school.
Along with Sammo Hung and a number of other very big Hong Kong action film stars.
Mm-hmm.
The reason wushu is more acrobatic is because it was being played up for the stage, which then just naturally transitioned over to film.
Mm-hmm. And it's one of the reasons why Bruce Lee is so distinctive on film, too, because he was one of the few stars of film who actually has a foundation in a practical style instead of something that's flashier, like Wushu and that sort of thing. If you've ever seen any of his movies, you'll see there's a lot of standing still. There are a lot of really quick, decisive strikes, and that's much more akin to what you're going to see in a practical style versus something that's built for media. The right. basic distinction is that a media style, and as an actor, I also have some experience with stage combat, and in stage combat, safety is your number one consideration. Even in the most hectic fight you've ever seen in a movie or TV show, chances are, especially because it's on film, they are whiffing like crazy. They're not even coming within feet of each other in terms of their strikes, because especially in America, if you get injured, that's a lawsuit, and then the whole shebang gets shut down. So safety is your first consideration in a media presentation, but the second consideration is something that looks engaging, something that you want to watch, as opposed to something that will help you survive. And that's one of the reasons why, at the extreme end of the spectrum, we see such flashy moves in kung fu, even in like fencing movies. The old stuff on celluloid is that's more practical because those people actually have a competitive fencing background. But then you get to, you know, what's the Three Musketeers movie with the Sutherland brother and
the Disney one.
Yeah. That sort of thing. It's much more of the swashbuckling. That's Flinning is what they call it, based on Errol Flynn. But he was actually even one of the more practical practitioners back in the day. But yeah, the goal with media martial arts is to tell a story in a safe way. Whereas with practical combat, the goal is usually to disable or kill a person. And in that situation, you're not trying to tell a story. You're just trying to deny your opponent options, right? The goal is to take away every option but to be hit by you or what have you.
Yep. Cool. So that sort of leads into our second section, which is the question of what are we trying to depict in games? So when we're using martial arts in a game, what is it that we're trying to depict? There are sort of those two opposing poles, but there's a lot of other things. So PK, can you get us started on that?
Yeah. And in my opinion, what you're trying to depict with martial arts is a story. Martial arts is a storytelling tool. It's a way for you to talk about your character's background, their history, their outlook on life, and their philosophy. So this is baked even into D&D. When you have your first level fighter and what weapon you choose is going to help you shape your character. Because most people are going to default to the longsword. It's sort of the default weapon that D&D is built around. But if you want to get creative, if you want to have your character stand apart, then you start looking at different weapons like spears or axes and things like that. And in my experience, almost everyone I've seen play a character with an axe is playing some sort of loud, gregarious barbarian with just a complete lust for life.
Yeah.
It's not your... Yeah, you don't have a dour paladin standing there in his plate armor with his mighty war axe. No, you've got... You know, you've got Hrothgar the Barbarian, who will drink from the skulls of his enemies. You know, that sort of thing. So, this ties back to earlier when I said your general philosophy ties into your martial art. Because anytime you train in something so strongly, it's going to affect your perspective on the world. And we understand that intuitively, and we tie that into how we build our characters. So, what you want to do is depict your character in a way that you think is fitting. And this is actually where I think Misdirected Mark got hung up. They talked a lot about not having the language to be able to describe the sorts of things that they see in kung fu movies, and were getting caught up on the idea of joint locks and strikes and throws and specific styles. I would like to say to everybody that you don't need to know that. You just don't. You don't have to get caught up with technical details. The broad strokes are going to be enough. Because when you describe something, our minds are filling in all the details already. You don't have to say that I'm going to capture him by the thumb and put him into a chicken wing lock before I flip him. Like, sure, some guys who know martial arts are going to understand that you grab him by the thumb and you jam it up behind his back and then you somehow flip him. But anybody else at the table is going to be like, what? Because you get too technical. So, in my opinion, saying, I swing with all my might in an overhead cut is just as good or better than saying, my Crane-style Kung Fu will defeat your Dragon-style, because nobody knows what the hell Crane-style or Dragon-style are. Chances are the people who wrote those movies don't know how those interplay. And actually...
Unless it's Kung Fu Panda, they know.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
All of that is just flavor. It's just, you know, it's just painting on the walls. You don't actually have to get into that. It's much more about being able to describe the mood and the tone of your martial art. Because I guarantee you, if you want to describe yourself as Jason Bourne, you can do that. You can just say, yeah, I pick up a pen and with these just short, vicious strokes, I start stabbing holes in the other guy's arm as he blocks my fist. You can say that. That's a vivid, evocative image that doesn't require super technical information. The most important thing is to understand the broad strokes of what you want your character to look like when they're fighting and how that conveys into their intent and their backstory.
Yeah, there's a Facebook group, Absolute Tabletop, and they, one of the guys who operates that group, he posted something, I think it was just yesterday, and he said, I want to crowdsource a list of approaches to combat. I'm not talking about specific techniques or styles. I'm just talking about, you know, brutal, efficient, flashy. Like, just single word descriptions are evocative enough to paint a picture for the rest of the people. Like you said, the audience, whether it's the other people at your table or somebody watching your video on YouTube or what have you, are going to be able to fill in the details for themselves.
Yep. And the thing that I find funny is... the fight in The Princess Bride between Inigo and the Man in Black is almost 100% a pure kung fu movie, fight, because it's these two masters who are sizing each other up and they're tossing back and forth this technical information that means absolutely nothing to the viewer, because 99% of the people watching that don't know who Bonetti is. They don't know why his defense would be useful on rocky terrain or why studying Agrippa would be useful against, I forget the third, swordsman. But none of that matters. It's just style and panache and little details that draw you in, but aren't necessary.
There's a scene in an episode of Leverage. It's the episode where they meet...
The two live crew job.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly what I'm about to say.
I do.
Because there's this moment where Elliot and the other hitter are just sizing each other up, and they're also looking around, and they each catch the other changing stances. And in their minds, they imagine what's going to happen because of that stance change. And it's just the most brilliant scene of having an entire fight in the mind. It's so good. It's so good.
Yep. Yeah, and I think that's also a really good example, not only because you see that sort of thing happen in Eastern movies a lot. In the movie Hero, whenever Donnie Yen and Jet Li are having the fight in the chess courtyard or whatever,
yes.
They fight the entire battle before either one of them have actually risen to their feet and attacked the other person. But that, like I said, is pretty ubiquitous in Eastern traditions, whereas, like, not only is this a Western tradition, but it's a modern Western tradition, and that sort of thing still happens, you know?
Yeah.
For an even more recent Western example, in the second to last episode of Star Wars Rebels in the third season, Darth Maul and Obi-Wan Kenobi have a showdown.
God, I love that.
it's so good. It's straight out of a samurai film.
Oh my god, you're so right.
These two guys sizing each other up. They each take two stances, and then there are three cuts.
Mm-hmm. And the fight is over. I've watched that fight like a million times. I love it so much. Because it's perfect for... So there's this anecdote that I read recently. There was a guy who was... he had a blog post where he was ranking all of the combatants in the Game of Thrones TV series. And he has some sort of training in some Western tradition. And his instructor told him, he would drill it into him. He said, "What do you want your enemy to do?" And it took a long time for this guy to get the right answer. But the answer is one thing. And not only do you, and so it's like, what do you want your enemy to do? One thing. When do you want your enemy to do it? When I choose him to do it, right? You want to, like I said earlier, you want to deny the options of your opponent, just like Obi-Wan and Maul did in their fight. And that's, it's just, it's perfect. I could watch it for the rest of my life.
So anyway, fanboy aside, it is really good though. Like, I love it. The big thing I'm trying to get across to people is don't get bogged down with florid prose and trying to outsmart yourself. You shouldn't do that. Just rely on the basics. If you want to be the fast martial artist who has the no shadow kick, which is just a classic kung fu trope, just say you have that. You don't have to talk about how many times you kick somebody or the number of punches you can throw or things like that. Just be quick, snappy, evocative, because the human mind is an incredible thing. It fills in all of these details on its own with just the slightest prompt. So that's, I really encourage people to just try and break out of their common mold of, oh, I hit him with my axe. Giving just a little bit of flavor is huge. But don't go off the deep end. You know, keep it short, snappy, because this is combat after all. The one thing that I think where I will step away from that is if you want there to be a dramatic pause in a fight so that you can do that classic, you know, pose, you know, strike a pose and gesture your opponent to come at you. Absolutely take the time to do that because it's awesome when it happens at the table.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So next, I want to talk about making martial arts feel distinctive and useful. And this is actually where we can get into the mechanics of a game. You do want to offer up some way to provide interesting variation between characters. And this is as simple as having the three subclasses for the fighter in 5th edition D&D. You have the sword mage, you have the guy who is basically a crit machine, and then you have the battle master who learns all sorts of different techniques. Those are three different styles of martial arts, but they're all the same class, and they all feel different. Contrast that with the monk, who again has three subclasses. You have the shadow mage, the sort of elemental bender, and then your sort of classic D&D monk. What those do is they each provide a different focus for telling your character's story and what they can do and how they do it in a story. I'm less concerned with the specific mechanics of a game, and I'm more concerned with how the mechanics help you tell your character's story. So having a character that is sort of, you know, the avatar from Last Airbender, being able to control the four elements, is going to feel very different. And you'll have a very different character arc than somebody who is playing the traditional D&D monk, which is kind of bland in a lot of ways. It's very much inspired by the classic kung fu tropes. So not a lot of people, or I shouldn't say not a lot of people, but there are people who don't understand the third edition monk and its place in D&D and how it fits in with everything, because it is coming from a narrative tradition that's outside of D&D.
Right.
But it is distinctive. It's different from the elemental bender. It's different from the shadow warrior or the ninja. And the way to achieve that is by giving the characters enough differentiation in the mechanics that mean things. So I'm actually going to step back to the fighter here. When you have the fighter who has all the different combat maneuvers, that's useful. It's interesting. And it tells a story about a character who has mastered techniques and knows how to control the flow of a battle. But when you do the other fighter build, I forget what it's called, but the one who basically has expanded crit range and massive critical damage, that is a much different type of character. That's somebody who is trusting more to luck and overwhelming brute force than any sort of attempt at controlling the battlefield. Those, even though they could have come from the same basic character sheet, those become very different characters. And the players will tell different stories with them. So, go ahead, Aaron.
So you would say, basically, a slight shift in game effect can have a huge, huge shift in the narrative effect.
Yes. Yeah, because narrative and mechanics are always interwoven. They're always intertwined and affecting each other. Not necessarily obviously, but they're always going to happen. So if you want to have a character that is that sort of overwhelming force person, don't build the battle master. Instead, mm-hmm. go for the guy who has the massive critical damage. Embrace the story you want to tell.
I have to tell my little anecdote about 3-5 in this. So I was playing a 3-5 game, and I decided on playing a Dwarven Defender. And the Dwarven Defender is the tankiest tank that 3-5 came up with. It is a damage sink that just you cannot kill, which is awesome.
Except I think you can get over 20 AC at first level, right?
Yeah, it's ridiculous. but what it doesn't have that just a little simple missing mechanic changed in 4th ed, what it doesn't have is any way to make sure that he's the one who's getting hit.
Mm-hmm.
And then suddenly 4th ed came out with a mark, and 5th ed has its own... in the maneuvers that you were talking about, it has its own mechanics as well. Just those little additions suddenly make that tank possible. And that's, you know, that difference in mechanic makes a huge difference in the story to me.
Yeah. The 4th edition fighter is brilliantly designed. Mm-hmm. It, the introduction of the mark and the idea that it incentivizes the GM to attack the player, which then gives the player a chance to be awesome.
Right.
Is just, it's brilliant game design. I absolutely love it. I played a sword mage in 4th edition mm-hmm. for a long, long time. And I played the teleporting sword mage the Aegis of Shielding. That's what it was. And once you hit Paragon levels, you can start teleporting and stabbing through teleportation holes and all sorts of things whenever an enemy who is marked by you does something that isn't attacking you. And it was just great fun.
That's awesome.
All right. So one thing you do want to avoid is stereotypes, because stereotypes are not always the most woke things out there. let's say, like, I mean, right. There are a lot of harmful stereotypes.
Absolutely.
I'll put it out there. and God, as much as I love it, you probably shouldn't be emulating early Shaw Brothers movies when you're doing your martial arts in games. Master of the Flying Guillotine, I don't think it was Shaw Brothers, but Master of the Flying Guillotine may be one of the most racist movies I have ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
It's great. It's awesome. It's got crazy martial arts action, but it relies heavily on racial stereotypes, and it's also kind of gross.
Mm-hmm.
So, stereotypes to avoid with martial arts in games is sort of the whooping, like, wah! Martial artist. If you are playing a kung fu character,
Liu Kang, if you will.
Yeah, don't do that. It's gross.
And I will say that Kiai is grounded in like an expression of chi to make a strike more powerful. But there is definitely a sensitive and an insensitive way to approach that tradition, and you don't want to be insensitive.
Yes, exactly. And then the other major one to avoid is going to be anything that is a parody of a cultural style. So if you are, because as we've discussed, every culture has martial arts. So if you are playing a character who's based on Native American traditions, don't turn them into a Native American stereotype. You know, don't have them doing all the harmful, like, you know, oh, strong magic bullshit. Don't do that. Be sensitive to the ideas of what actual cultures are like. And if you want a great example of things to not do, watch Master of the Flying Guillotine. Also known as War Boxer 2.
Right. There was also, and I grew up in the 80s, and that was the era of the white ninja. There were so many movies and TV shows in that era that completely twisted what ninjutsu is and what a ninja is, and every single one of them made a white American dude who should have been on a surfboard into a ninja.
Sometimes literally with surf ninjas.
Yep.
Though that was the 90s.
Yeah, that was the 90s. Same with Three Ninjas, I think, but it's the same general.
Three Ninjas, yep. Though, I mean, at least with Three Ninjas, those boys were a quarter Japanese.
Right.
Were they? Well, except the guy who was playing their grandpa is actually a Chinese actor, so... Oh. Dated inconsistencies aside.
All right. Anything else to add to what we're trying to depict, Eli?
The only thing I wanted to add was that whenever we're talking about a role-playing game, especially in the context of D&D, we're talking about fantasy gaming, we are able to depict not just combat styles and techniques, but we're also able to depict the mystical side of a martial art. And PK, you touched on this with, the three variations on those, on the fighter and the monk, each they have their straight physical expression, and then they have like an elemental expression or a magic based expression, and it gives you an opportunity to, like, you know, chi is something that's really common in a lot of Eastern martial arts, and it's something that is a little different in every martial art, but it's something that you can actually express with something as an element of the real world whenever you're dealing with fantasy and stuff like that.
Yeah, there are a number of games that use chi as a player resource to power special attacks and things like that, which is certainly one way of approaching it.
Mm-hmm. I will say that's probably another one of those areas where you need to be really sensitive to the cultural tradition, and you don't want to, like, you don't necessarily want to go Dragon Ball Z on something, even though that is a Japanese saga or a Japanese setting. You definitely want to handle it with care.
It's definitely the idea of chi-powered martial arts is a stereotype, and it's not, it's kind of borderline. It depends on how it's handled in many ways. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep. It always, I mean, just with many things, it comes down to treat it with respect and you should be okay.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. So what I wanted to talk about, I wanted to take a look at just a couple of specific games. One of the things that I was in the chat room the night that the Misdirected Mark episode 250 was recorded, and I was posting things like, are you guys talking about Feng Shui? And they said, oh, well, we haven't really read Feng Shui. And I was facepalming, because if you're gonna talk about martial arts, we gotta talk about Feng Shui. And so that's what I'm gonna do right now. So, Eli, you've had a chance to look at Second Ed at this point?
Yeah, yeah.
And PK, you have definitely read some of the, and played it a little bit as well?
Yes, I have.
So there are a couple of things that really stand out as being what I think of as the key mechanics for telling that story, for depicting something unique about martial arts within a game. The first big thing, and this is the most important thing for me in Feng Shui, is the shot clock. The way that Feng Shui does initiative is just inherently it's inherently cinematic martial arts in ways that I have not seen any other game really manage, and that's because it breaks things down more than this round I do X. So you've got this shot clock. So everybody has their initiative, and that puts them at a number on the shot clock. And then the action that you take spends some of your shots, and you move down the shot clock. Whoever is next on the shot clock goes, and in Feng Shui Second Edition, players go first always, which is nice. It's just a friendly thing to do. But the key is that different powers cost different numbers of shots. Different actions cost different numbers of shots. So if you're starting at, let's say, 16, which is pretty high, actually, and you do a three-shot action, now you're at a 13. If you were first and someone else was at 14, now they're going to go. And if you just keep trading three-shot actions, well, it's going to be like normal initiative. But if you say, well, I'm at a 16, I'm going to do this one shot action really quick, and now I'm going to go again. Mm-hmm. And now I'm going to take my three shot action. So I got to do a little bit of a setup first, and then I took my action. And there's that sort of second by second strategy that really defines things. And now the thing is, if you look at the archetypes in Second Edition, this wasn't as much the case in First Edition, but if you look at the archetypes in Second Edition, almost all of them have mostly one-shot or three-shot actions, which makes it kind of samey. But once you start advancing, even in Second Edition, there's two-shot actions, there's four-shot actions, there's X-shot actions, which is really great because now I'm deciding how much I'm going to spend to power up this particular thing. And so you've got all this stuff that's really, it's making all of the strategy, and all of this happens in the space of about 80 seconds. So the entire round happens in the space of 80 seconds, and I've done six or seven actions. And that, to me, really conveys the feel of what we're trying to emulate. Mm-hmm. So that I think is one of the big things about Feng Shui.
Yeah, not only does it give you a longer amount of time per round to accomplish things, but you also get the back and forth interplay, like the tug of war between different characters. Like, oh, I did this thing, and now, oh, I opened you up to do this thing in response, but then I get to go again, and that sort of thing.
Exactly. And
the flexibility to approach a combat in a way that you want to is very much there. Mm-hmm. Because tied in with the shot clock is Feng Shui has a pretty loose movement system. Mm-hmm. So you can cover a lot of ground or basically just go where you need to within a scene in addition to doing whatever it is that you want to do, whether it costs one or two or three shots.
Yeah. Because, again, that's reflective of the stories that we're trying to tell. It's not an interesting story in a moment in this particular kind of story to say, well, I'm going to take a couple rounds and just get there. No, we don't want to do that. We want to be there. We want to be doing the thing. So that's sort of, to me, all of those powers really differentiate the different feels inside combat. And then the other thing that I've loved since first edition is the character development systems, the way that you buy new shticks, and the shticks that are opened up to you. So this is still a little bit there in second edition, but it was much more so in first edition, which was the shtick trees. And you could see sort of in those trees, this is what this particular style does. And I can see all the kinds of moves that I'll be learning, and I might not be there yet, but I'm aspiring to that. And that shapes how I tell the story of my character, because I'm thinking about where I'm going to be eventually. And that to me, I think, is an important consideration in a martial arts system, is the idea that I'm not just adding powers. I am planning ahead, and my training is evoked by where it's going, not just by where it's been.
Yeah, you're walking a martial path.
Yeah, exactly. So as we get into our games, I'll talk about how that is something I definitely tried to emulate in my own design. Anything you guys want to add about Feng Shui?
Yeah, so my experience is I actually played the martial artist. That was my character archetype. And I liked how the abilities I had that were powered by the key points I could spend didn't add any shots to the clock, but they either upped my damage or gave me extra attacks around. So one of them let me make counterattacks anytime a mook attacked me, which could be pretty cool depending on the scene. And another one made my nunchucks have basically the highest damage in the game, because I turned into Bruce Lee for a scene. And that's just cool. And that's the sort of thing that I was going with for what am I trying to depict? I don't need to name the nunchucks are suddenly the deadliest weapon in the game, anything fancy. I just need to give a description of it. And then once the player reads that, they're like, wow, why does this nunchuck do more damage than a shotgun? I don't know, but that's cool. Let's roll with it.
Yeah. My own experience of Feng Shui, I've only been able to read the rules. I haven't been able to play it yet. And my experience is also only with the second edition. But I like that they have 36 different archetypes that you can choose from, and that there's such a variety in there too. There's the martial artist, like you said, PK. I noticed there were two that were really similar, the Sifu and the Old Master. The Old Master is more of like the wizened old guy up on the mountaintop, the what's his name? The Cruel Tutelage of Pai Mei. Is that from Kill Bill? Pai Mei, is that the guy's name?
Yeah.
That's sort of his shtick. And then you've got the Sifu, who's more like Wang Kai-ying in Iron Monkey, for anybody who's seen that. He's the wizened guy also, but he's a healer, and he has like pressure point control instead. And it was just really cool to see the ways that they captured these different martial arts tropes within these different characters. So anybody who wants to run some Feng Shui out there, let me know, and I'm all for it.
I think we could probably set you up. So one of the things that Robin Laws had expressed in making the second edition was an intention to make the system simpler. And I think my take is that mostly it's simpler to pick up and play. It's not necessarily a huge amount simpler. The mechanics are pretty similar to first edition. But it still has a ton of options, which is what I like. I like the options for advancement and other stuff. But the intention was to make it simple to pick up. So one of the questions that I sort of had for you guys in thinking about that intention is how can we do that? How is it possible for a sort of a combat focused martial arts stylistic game to be simple to pick up? What do you think about that? Does it achieve it, first of all, and are there other games that do?
I think for the most part, the system in Feng Shui 2 it's dead simple. Your attacks have a certain shot cost and deal a certain amount of damage, and that's not variable. It's very simple, straightforward, easy to do, and all of the abilities that you have are very clearly explained. Mm-hmm. Which isn't to say that it can't get complex as you progress down the road, but the archetypes in that game are very, very well planned, very well designed, and can be run right out of the gate by anyone I know who has played an RPG. So that's a major boon to it. Another game that I would recommend if you wanted to run a Kung Fu, specifically sort of a more cinematic Kung Fu style martial arts campaign, would actually be Fate. Because a lot of the narrative beat structure in a Kung Fu movie is creating advantages and overcoming the obstacles that your opponent sets in front of you, and then eventually building up your advantages so that you get one powerful strike in. There's not a lot of attrition in a classic Kung Fu movie fight. And that's something that Fate can do very, very well in just right out of the box. Actually, way back in 2013, when Fate Core hit Kickstarter, the first campaign I ran with the playtest rules was a Kung Fu game, and it went quite well.
Cool.
Very nice.
Yeah, and you had mentioned earlier the approaches, which is certainly a Fate Accelerated thought. The yep. descriptions.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. Yeah, that I think approaches is a really good way, or a really good way to think about the way that your character is approaching combat, even if you're not playing Fate Accelerated.
Yeah,
because you can apply those six descriptions to any action you're doing in any RPG, and it adds a layer of information to what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, without adding a whole lot of complexity, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think in terms of whether a martial arts system in a game can be simple, I think it depends a lot on what you're trying to represent. For example, I think a system that captures the spirit of Iaijutsu really well, Iaijutsu being the Japanese sword art that essentially tries to refine combat down to a single cut. But I think a system that models that really well is Reflections from Third Act Publishing.
Yes.
It's the thing that tripped me up whenever you were asking the question is that you were asking if it's a game that's about combat, and I would argue that Reflections is not so much about combat as it is about an interpersonal relationship between the two characters. But realistically, if your style is based on the actions of a single cut, then you can have an extremely simple martial arts system. I would say also, though, even if you're going for something that's more robust, the three basic actions of martial arts are attack, defend, and maneuver. And I think you can build off of that to create something that's fairly simple, but still engaging and still provides a lot of tactical meat in the moment.
Cool. All right. So my second case study is one that I know neither of you are familiar with, but I'm hoping that that I can express something as I describe it to you and explain it to you that will be useful to listeners as well. And that is Shinobi Gami. And I just want to make sure I've sent you guys a link to the character sheet. And if you're listening at home or wherever you are, look at the character sheet at some point. If you can look at it while I'm talking, that's great. It is extremely visual, and I'm going to try and describe it as best I can.
And robust.
Yeah. So I'm only going to focus on a couple of things. I'm not going to go into all of the mechanics of Shinobi Gami, but I especially want to take a close look at the skill matrix. So the skill matrix is sort of the core mechanic around which Shinobi Gami is built. And it is this chart that is 11 rows deep and 6 columns wide. So it's a 2-12 versus and then 6 columns, 6 categories of descriptions. And in every single box, there is a word. And the columns sort of define what types of words are going to be in that column, but then they're all over the place. So, for instance, there's a stealth category, and it is a set of skills that includes things that you might expect, like infiltration and disguise. But it also includes things like olfaction, which is I'm good at smelling things, or ventriloquism, which is just an amazing skill to throw into a grid, especially when, and this is the key, every single word on this can be your primary attack skill. And that's the thing that's just amazing about this. So there's this tech category where apparel is one of the skills. And apparel covers both wearing and making apparel. And you think, well, how is that an attack skill? If you've seen enough anime, you know.
Mm-hmm. Or if you've seen enough classic kung fu movies.
Yeah, absolutely. Iron Monkey. Yes.
Iron Monkey, the villain of that film, has robes that he can shoot the sleeves of his robes out, and they smash stone walls.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Same sort of story with House of Flying Daggers.
Yes. And then, or you've got something like contacts in the strategy column, and contacts, you're like, well, how do I attack with contacts? Well, I've got buddies. I don't do the attacking. I've got mooks.
That's awesome.
And I roll that skill for my mooks to attack. And that's what I'm doing. Same with creature mastery or something like that. So I've got all of these different things. This amazing array of things that can be my primary attack skills, and various other powers can be built off different ones. Now, the way that this grid works is pretty amazing. So let's say that I have that apparel attack skill and I'm attacking somebody. So what they do is they look at their, so you get like, I can't remember if it's 5 or 6. You get a certain number of skills that you circle. These are the skills that I have. And then some of your powers are attached to them, and otherwise they're things that you can do that you're good at. And you can do anything on this. Well, not quite anything, but most of the things on this grid you can do. But the difficulty is based on how close it is to one of your primary skills. So if I've got apparel, I can climb fairly well because that is 2 blocks away from apparel. And that's sort of how things work on this. And then the attacking, let's say I was attacking somebody who had speed, which is in the next column over, which is in the martial arts column. If I'm attacking with my apparel, they're defending with speed. their difficulty to defend is counted by the number of blocks away from a peril it is. And this is also why, if you're looking at the sheet, you'll see that there are sort of extra mini columns between them. Mm-hmm. So a peril technically is 1, 2, 3 blocks away from speed because of that mini column in between. But if martial arts is my primary category, I shade in the columns on either side of it, so I have a better chance to defend to the things that are near it. So this whole visual grid just gives this amazing array of interactions just by hitting these keywords and measuring distance from one to the other. It's probably the best depiction of anime style combat that I have ever seen. Like, when you spend some time with this grid, you start to say, oh yeah, that was in this series. Oh yeah, and totally, that was in this series. Seduction as an attack. Oh yeah, totally, I've seen that. And that's that sort of thing. So you've got all of those things going on in this grid.
I love that one of the skills is cooking.
Mm-hmm. Well, how much Ranma have you watched?
Yeah.
the one I like the most is finances.
Right?
You just pay people to fight for you.
Uh-huh.
You may punch me in the face, but I have wreaked your financial ruin. That's awesome.
But yeah. So then there's a lot more going on in this system that's really cool. Like, so that column on the right, with your, Ogi, that is a special skill that is hidden, which is why you can cut it. So you hide it behind your character sheet, and when you reveal it, it automatically works. So the first time you reveal it, it automatically works. It's so good. And your character has a secret, and you can get bonuses by revealing your secret in a flashback during combat. So there's all this just really great narrative stuff going on that's all tied into these combat mechanics, because again, we're telling that story through the martial arts. And it's just brilliant.
That's so cool.
So those were sort of the two case studies that, when I was listening to the Mess Directed Mark episode, I really, really wanted to just jump on the mics and start talking about. So do you guys have any that you would like to add?
Well, the one that I'm really excited to try out is not actually a role-playing game. It's a card game that I backed on Kickstarter recently. And because it's a card game, it has different design goals. So this isn't necessarily 100% relevant to the conversation. But one of the things I talked about whenever I was setting up what are the martial arts is the idea that in a practical martial arts system, the goal is to be as efficient as possible. You are trying to deny your opponent options while also striking to defeat them, right? And there's this Kickstarter that came out a little while ago called Clash of Steel, and it's a two-player card game that's supposed to take no more than 20 minutes. And from the look of it, from what I've seen of an example of play on YouTube and taking a quick look at some of the cards, it seems like it's a really good tactical representation of a HEMA martial art or something like a more efficient Japanese art, like Iaijutsu or something like that. The point being that you choose a stance for the round, and you choose a weapon for the round, and you choose an attack to a particular part of your opponent's body. And your opponent does the same thing. And then based on the selections that both of you have made, you have cards that you can play that modify your attack power. And basically, these two stances with these two these two tactics charge at each other, and you see who managed to defend themselves the best while at the same time attacking their opponent's weaker spot. And it just seems like it's going to be a really cool, frenetic example of martial arts in gaming, even if it's not necessarily a role-playing game.
Sure. And it's the sort of thing that can lead to other exploration in RPGs later.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, and honestly, if I were to design a martial arts system for a role-playing game, I would want it to look a lot like this. Instead of having an HP system, I would want to have a system where instead it's like, you're not whittling away their health, you're whittling away their options, and eventually they have no more options left but to be run through the gut with your sword or something.
Mm-hmm. PK, did you have any others?
No, I just wanted to make a quick comment. Clash of Steel sounds like it is sort of an implementation of, I can't remember the name of it, but there was in the 70s a fighter pilot, sort of a World War I or World War II fighter pilot war game where it was all booklets. And you started off with scenarios, and the booklets basically handled, you picked a maneuver and your opponent picked a maneuver, and then you compared what maneuvers you took, and that told you what pages to flip to determine your next positioning. It seems like Clash of Steel is sort of a spiritual successor to that idea.
Yeah, I wonder. The guy, he answered a lot of questions about the game while the Kickstarter was running, so I'm going to have to pour through those answers and see if he had anything about his inspirations, because it sounds like it's definitely thematically similar, if nothing else.
Yeah.
One of the things that struck me about looking at it was that it... I am friends with people who are fight choreographers, and they're actually... So R&D choreography in Chicago is one of their goals early in their careers was to develop a language and a notation system for describing stage combat that could be used in shorthand and in a written sense, so in much the same way that dance choreographers can notate their movements, so especially in ballet. So it struck me as similar in a lot of ways to what they're doing with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say so.
All right. Cool. So since we are all coming at this from the standpoint of having designed games with martial arts in mind, let's talk about our games. PK, let's have you start with Three Rocketeers and what you were doing with that.
All right. So Three Rocketeers is a swashbuckling space opera game that combines the fencing swashbuckling stories of Alexandre Dumas with Flash Gordon and other planetary romance stories. My goal with Three Rocketeers was to have a game where fencing was the primary way of solving violent conflict. I didn't want to have ray guns and, you know, devolve into a shooting match. I wanted people to be engaging in duels and doing so in an interesting way. So I actually developed some mechanics for creating your own style based around the weapons you carried and sort of your general approach to combat. Then I also tied that into your aspects so that you get to describe your fighting style with an aspect of your own choosing. And the idea here is I was going for people to evoke a tone of flinning. I want them to be up there swinging or flying through the air at each other with these great big swings and a clash of swords, sparks fly, and then they dive back down into the hulk of a spaceship as it tumbles from the skies. So that's what I focused on.
And so how, because one of the things that I love about Three Rocketeers is the ways that you differentiated those styles and sort of the system that you used for dividing them up. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Three Rocketeers uses, like I said, you get to build your own style, and it is based off of four different categories. You have your weapon, which is Each category has 5 different options in the base game. You can make more if you want to. But yeah, so you get to choose your weapon. So I have the saber, the long sword, broad sword, the rapier, and I think the small sword as your options. Then you have your offhand, which is you can do basically a second sword, a dagger, a cloak, an empty hand, or a buckler. You have your edge, which is the one trick that your character knows that nobody else does. And then you have the appearance. So basically the outward flashiness of your style and how you approach combat, which is important in a game that's trying to evoke these wild, over-the-top duels. Each category of the game, or each category of the style, affects a different action in Fate Core. So your weapon is actually going to affect your attack skills. Generally speaking, your offhand affected your defense. Edge, I believe, was used to create advantages. And then appearance... No, I take that back. Edge was used to overcome obstacles. And then appearance was creating advantages. So your style consists of one item from each of those at character creation. As you go along, you can pick up more options, which gives you a greater flexibility. If this were Princess Bride, you could start off with one defense, but then switch to another. You know, you could change it up from, oh, I don't want to use my open hand. Now I want to use my cloak as my defensive item.
I gotta say, that sounds so cool. I love in particular that you have things for both hands to do. That's awesome.
Yeah. So, for the math inclined, that is, I believe, 5 to the 4th combinations.
Yeah, it's a lot of stuff.
It's a lot of different
I think it comes out to 625 options.
Jeez. Yep. Here's a question, though. So with the longsword, is that a two-handed weapon? Do you have to fill your offhand with that as well, or can you still have something else in your other hand?
You can still have something else in the other hand because it's cinematic.
Sure.
Realism was not a major consideration in a game that has rocket packs.
What? Blasphemy.
Cool. PK, anything else to add about Three Rocketeers?
People should buy it. Actually, I mean, they don't even have to buy it. It's pay what you want on drive-thru. People should get it, read it, play it, and then tell me about it because I love that darling little game, and I want more people to play it.
Yeah, sounds good. I also want more people to play it. They should definitely let you know when they do. So my game, one of my games, is Steamscapes, and it is my ongoing steampunk Savage World setting. And for the second major book, which was Steamscapes Asia, I did do a section on martial arts. And because of my approach to steampunk in Steamscapes, and the way that I've addressed it, that definitely helped characterize how I wanted to address martial arts. So Steamscapes is a historical steampunk setting. There's no magic arcane power of any kind. And it is realistic as much as possible technology. And the other thing about it is that unlike a lot of other steampunk, it is sort of anti-colonial, anti-imperialist. So a lot of the focus is on the non-European cultures and nations, and making them more prominent in this steampunk setting. And so when I stepped over to Steamscapes Asia, it was very important to me to make those historical elements and and really include them as part of the martial arts. So the first thing I did was I researched a ton of different martial arts from the region from the 19th century. Because what a lot of people don't realize is that a lot of martial arts that we have around now, that we think of as, oh, these are ancient, were actually created late 19th, early 20th century, if not later. Mm-hmm. Many of the more prominent Asian martial arts are, especially the ones that, we see in tournament competition, these days are modern. They're basically modern. So when you're looking back, when you're trying to come up with things, you have to say, well, I can't have Aikido, but there are things that Aikido comes from that have, similar philosophies and approaches, and that's what I want to bring in. The other thing was that I wanted to, as I was doing the research, I wanted to make sure that I was including martial arts from outside of China, Japan, and Korea. I wanted a bunch of martial arts that were not necessarily what we think of as, oh, that's a kung fu movie, or that's a Japanese ninja movie, or whatever. I wanted other things. So I have a bunch of Indian martial arts. I have Southeast Asian martial arts. I have Arnis, which is the Filipino martial arts, other things like that. And I really wanted to focus on that idea. The other thing that I wanted was to really make sure that each thing felt like that style. Like when I'm playing a character that is an Arnis master, it should feel like that. It should feel like I'm doing that. And so, for instance, Arnis is a huge parry art. So it's extremely focused on the idea of I'm going to block everything you do. And so building that in was very important to me. The other thing was that I was designing for Savage Worlds, and I've observed over the years, and Eli, you can probably agree with this, that when you're playing a lot of Savage Worlds games, and people play physical melee characters, they end up kind of samey. There's a certain set of edges that tend to be the ones that people grab. Maybe they'll grab one before the other, but once you get to a certain point, these are the ones they've got because they're the ones that are effective. And I wanted to mix that up a little bit. And while I wanted to include those because they do describe things that happen in many martial arts, I wanted to add things that were unique. So what I did was I created a set of maneuvers, and these maneuvers are not edges, but they become edges within an individual martial art. So for instance, there's a maneuver called defensive footwork, and several different martial arts have defensive footwork, but it looks different depending on where you're using it. So Gatka is the Sikh sword art. It's one that's focused on the idea of positioning your body and using your footwork. There's a particular gait that's used, and it's, if you've ever seen videos of someone practicing it with the fight, it looks painful because it's a deep knee bend. You're almost walking crouched, and they move with this sort of these long steps, but with their knees almost completely bent, so that they're down to the ground. It's a very interesting sort of footwork, but it's going to look different, for instance, from Mardani Kel, which is a completely different martial art that also has defensive footwork, but it just looks different ways. And that was what I was really trying to convey. So within this, I have these different maneuvers, and they become accessible by the different martial arts styles. So several martial arts might start similarly, but then branch off in different ways. And again, I'm tapping into those feng shui trees. And if you have the Steamscapes Asia book, you'll see 3 pages worth of martial arts edge trees. And the idea for those is that I can start with martial artist and branch off to several different. So I can go to Bajiquan, picking up brawler and then the unarmed stunning strike, which is one of those maneuver edges. Or I can be a bando fighter, pick up extraction and improved extraction. And that's a different focus if you know what those edges do in Savage Worlds. It's you can see that that kind of fighter is going to tell a different story. And again, having that tree gives me something to look forward to see, okay, these are the things that this style does later. So even if I'm not doing them yet, that's how I'm thinking about my martial arts style. So those are all the things that I was trying to do with Steamscapes.
Yeah, and I've had a chance to play Steamscapes too, and I really appreciated the way all the martial arts went into it. You said that you had worked with one of your fight choreography friends to develop a lot of that, right?
Yeah, so I actually worked with a couple of them. And I worked with both Richard and Vic. Vic is actually, if you listen to the One Shot podcast episode, he's in that recording. So it's Allie and Drew and Vic as my and then James as my players for the Steamscapes Asia Pod one-shot episodes.
Very nice.
So they are also gamers, and we played just an intense set of sessions where I threw a bunch of different martial artists at a bunch of different levels at them and said, "Does this feel like this style?" And that was the way that we tested that.
Very cool. Yeah, so my game is The Blackwood. I also developed it for Savage Worlds, and it actually just recently wrapped up its Kickstarter, so it is not quite out in the world yet, but it will be by November, so get excited, everybody. The Blackwood, in a nutshell, is a mashup between Grimm's Tales and Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. I wanted to create a world that was inspired by folklore rather than traditional fantasy tropes, and I also wanted to create a world that had a lot of high-flying martial arts action. So whereas Steamscapes focused on realistically different styles, mine was more about a wuxia vibe. I wanted to have the light body skill that you see Li Mu Bai using in Crouching Tiger and all those wuxia movies. And so that element was actually not part of the fighting school system that I developed. It's a separate edge, because I didn't want someone to be pigeonholed into being a physical combatant in order to use that ability. Something that I wanted to be a little more ubiquitous than that. But the fighting school system that I developed is one of the setting rules, and my goal for that was to allow people to create their own martial arts systems in a way that was still tactically satisfying. Sort of in the same vein as Eric, I wanted to capitalize on lesser utilized maneuvers and mechanics in the Savage World system. Yeah, so what I did in the Blackwood, essentially there are 9 schools that you can study in. And of those 9 schools, 3 of them are what you would consider hidden or secret or advanced schools, so you actually have to progress a little in one of the other 6 before you're eligible to take one of these 3. And then also between those 9 schools, they all break down into a pretty basic rock, paper, scissors triangle, essentially. The schools are either going to boil down to the formless philosophy of the river, the resilient philosophy of the wood, or the mystical philosophy of the celestial sphere. And based on which one you're using, for example, celestial schools overcome the physical prowess of wood schools, and wood schools are better than river, and river are better than celestial. And you get a small bonus depending on which one you are fighting. So automatically you've got a little bit of interplay between these styles. But like I said, you can mix and match the different schools. So the idea is that each one of these schools capitalizes on something different that happens in real-world martial arts. I didn't draw upon any specific styles, but I did draw upon my own personal knowledge of various martial arts that I've studied, either by, like, in the dojo or just on the internet. And so, for example, you know, in the Wood philosophy, you've got the Boar school, which is all about straightforward attacks. It's about pushing your opponents back. It's about capitalizing on, you know, if you incapacitate someone, you can immediately make a free attack against someone else. You've also got schools like this style that I developed called Josudo, which is a style from outside the Blackwood, but it's based on the Widelander culture. The Widelanders are, long story short, they are basically, if you're not from the Blackwood, then you're from the Widelands, so you could be just about anybody. But one of the cultures out in the Widelands has a martial art that's very similar to capoeira. And so that style is a river style instead of a wood style. And that focuses on teamwork. So if you practice Josudo, then you are better at giving your allies bonuses in combat if you're adjacent to them. The idea being that in real-world capoeira, you've got these people who are gathered in a circle, and then they get together and they have these one-on-one duels or one-on-two duels or something like that, but they're always aware of where they are in this wider group, and that helps them to navigate hectic melees a little better. But yeah, so you could pick, you know, you could say, I'm going to study Boar School, and I become an aspiring student in Boar School. In that sense, it is kind of an edge tree progression, and it gives you a little bit of a look into where you will go if you follow that martial path. So, for example, Boar School, if you're an aspiring student, you get Stance of the Rampant Tusk, which gives you lets you bypass some armor from your opponents. And then if you take that edge again, then you learn the Bone Brow Pummel. And that means that every time you hit, if you get a raise on your roll, then you also knock your opponent back a little bit. If you take the edge one more time, then you unlock the master ability of that school, the Rolling Thunder Stance, which is the one where I said if you incapacitate someone, you can immediately attack somebody else who's adjacent to you. And so you've got this progression within each school, but you can also mix and match. It's a free action to change between schools, but you can only have one active school at a time. So you could be a worthy student in the Boar School and have two of those abilities unlocked, and then you could be an aspiring student in Josudo, and you could use the first ability of that school as well, and you can switch between those freely during combat. You can just only have one active during a round. But then there are also, like I said, these hidden schools. So, for example, the one that I think is maybe the most fun is the Way of the Gourd, and it's inspired by drunken boxing. And the way these advanced schools work, you have to be at least a worthy student in one of the previous schools to be able to study in this one. You have to prove that you're worthy before you're allowed to study these advanced techniques, and then they give you yet even more bonuses. And the way I picture it working is that an individual character will choose any given school, and they will accumulate abilities, but as they pick different schools and as they bring more schools into their expertise, they build their own style, and they get to, instead of following a template, they get to describe how this synthesis happens uniquely for their character. And maybe that means that eventually they can open up a school of their own. One of the things beyond just simple combat, I wanted to capture this idea that the path toward mastery of a martial art involves teaching other people as well. What's the saying? You retain 80% of what you teach to someone else or something like that. And so if you become a master of the school, then you get to ignore level requirements for taking on sidekicks, getting followers, that sort of thing. And you can kind of get a head start on your own school for a style. And yeah, you know, like I said, with the Boar School, they have specific names for their attacks. Every school has that sort of thing. But what I really wanted to do was make those suggestions rather than rules, because by the time you get all these different schools together, you probably have a pretty clear idea of what your character's unique synthesis of styles looks like, and maybe even what it's called.
Cool. So hopefully that's given people a decent idea of how we have approached our design. One of the things that I definitely notice is differentiation and options are kind of the consistent pieces that exist across the three designs. So let's leverage that into what elements make for a good martial arts system in a game. I think those are two that I would say. What else?
I would actually say that the system should guide you in describing your game or your actions in the game. It doesn't need to be full on fourth edition D&D, a title, flavor description, and then mechanical effect. But the language of the game should give you the tools in order to describe your actions within the game. And that's something that not many games do very well.
Yeah, I think that is extremely important.
Mm-hmm.
I would agree.
I would too. What I've heard from both of you so far is that options are good, but you don't want them to be restrictive. And I would agree with both of those things. As far as what I would add for what makes a good martial arts system, there are martial arts and there are games where it's appropriate for one decisive blow to determine the entirety of a combat. But especially for more cinematic systems, you want to have something that isn't going to give you that one-shot kill. You want to have a little bit of an interplay between these two sides, because like we said, part of the goal of a martial arts system is to tell a story about your character. And you don't necessarily want to write a novel, but you also don't want to tell a story in a tweet. You know, you want to find a middle ground there. So that's I think what I would consider to be most important, having some sort of interplay nature in the martial art.
Cool. Anything else to add?
Well, I think it's fair to say at this point that Chris and Phil and Old Man Logan, we have thrown the gauntlet, and we hereby challenge you to an honorable duel. You can pick the weapons, but I think we should pick the terrain. So where do we want to fight these guys, huh?
I will be the second. I'll be meeting Chris at Origins, so we'll figure it out there.
Okay, sounds good. Yeah. So you guys talk it out, and then we'll determine. And I guess this time next year, we'll meet on the new moon at midnight, and we will perform the rites and determine who is the victor.
All right. So although this is a maybe one-time podcast, we should still go through the rigmarole that podcasts like to go through. So PK, where can people find you on the internet?
The best place is to find me on Twitter. I am at PK_Sullivan because I tweet entirely too much.
Sounds good. How about you, Eli?
The best place for me would be Google Plus, and you can find me under my name, Eli Kurtz, although I am also on Twitter under ZapDynamic.
And I am on a little bit more on Google Plus, a little bit less on Twitter, though both of them are a little bit less likely to find me at the moment, just because I'm so deep in my other work that keeps me doing social media for Ulysses Spiel. So I'm mostly behind the scenes being the social media for that. But if you want to find me, I am also on Google Plus as Eric Simon, and you can look for the steampunk Darkwing Duck, and you can find me on Twitter at Fairman Rogers. So those are the two places to find us, find me. Well, guys, I really appreciate you getting together with me tonight.
Yeah, no, this was awesome. I had a great time talking with you guys.
Yes, this was a lot of fun.
And we'll keep an eye out. Maybe we'll have to come back someday. But until then, let's call it a night.
We're here whenever Gotham needs us.
We're not the podcast you need, but we are the podcast you deserve.
That's right.
All right. Thank you all.